if you have any questions about what we discussed yesterday, you can let me know now or anytime. So I'm going to do a little bit about unsupervised learning algorithms in this session. And so what these algorithms do, or what they're about, is that sometimes you have data, or the experience, as they say, that is not labeled, right? Like, so when you discuss the supervised learning idea, typically you had pairs of features or data and a label, right? Like, I think you discussed this supervised learning of the icing model, where you have a low temperature phase and a high temperature phase. And then you had that the X was the data, and each X was labeled according to whether this spin configuration was drawn at a low temperature in the order phase or at high temperature in the disorder phase, right? So there was this this common thing, which is always there's a signal or label that guides the learning of the algorithm, right? And the same is the same is true when you do, for instance, regression, right? Like linear fitting and so on. You always have a certain X, and then you have some Y, which is what you're trying to fit. So then you have that same signal, right? Like you have this label or this Y that is guiding your learning. And sometimes you don't have any of that. Like sometimes you just have a big bunch of observations and you don't have a label, but you can still, or you may still want to do some machine learning to understand these data sets. And so typically when you're in that situation, that's what you call unsupervised learning, okay? So let me write it down quickly. Unsupervised learning. So you have some, it's a set of algorithms where the data or the experience, as some people say, or experience, isn't labeled. Isn't labeled yet. We would still like to use this data to understand some characteristic about it, okay? And then typically there are several unsupervised learning algorithms, and I'm going to write like three categories, but this is not extensive. So I'm going to just mention a few, right? Like, but for instance, you can, given a data set of observations X, right, like x1, x2, through xm, you can do many things, right? Like, so I'm going to enumerate a few that are common and that are useful for what we do and what they do in machine learning in general. So one of them is we would like to learn the entire distribution P of X, meaning that you have a set of observations and you would like to infer the underlying distributions out of which you, or this data set has been drawn, right? So for instance, if you think about classical statistical mechanics, and then you have, I don't know, some Hamiltonian, and then you get a big bunch of configurations, you could potentially even try to learn that distribution, right? Like, even though we know the answer, right? Like that's the, what's this P in that case is the Boltzmann distribution, right? Like if we're in thermal equilibrium, but I mean, that's the point, right? Like that in some cases, in many cases, we don't know what the underlying distribution is, okay? So we, so for instance, suppose you have a big bunch of images of digits, right? Like this is one of the favorite examples that we were discussing, or that you discussed at some point last week or even before that. And then, so you would like to understand what's this distribution of how is it that people write handwritten digits, right? So that's one of the tasks in unsupervised learning. And this is called also density estimation. Kind of like density means probability, right? Like what's the probability of a given X in a data set? So that's one topic that we like, that we find useful in physics. And and this is also interesting from the like in quantum mechanics somehow, because in quantum physics we think about the wave function, right? Like, which is okay, it's not a probability, but this Born rule, which kind of like relates the wave function to probability of an observation. Okay, so in some sense, you can understand the wave function as a, once you square it, as a generative model of what we observe at the microscopic level. Okay, so this is kind of like something that we would like to think about it, that we use, and then you're gonna have examples of this coming next week, I think, with Giacomo, right? So where he tries to infer what the wave function is out of data in experimental, so out of experiments based on quantum devices and quantum systems, right? Like, so you can imagine using extensions of this unsupervised learning techniques to learn wave functions, okay? So that's kind of like a remark, or kind of like looking into the future a little bit, like next week. But we also, sometimes we, even if we could not estimate P, sometimes we can, we would like to generate samples, right? Like according to P of X, so synthesis or generation of samples. According to P of X. So sometimes you don't need to have an explicit density for you to be able to draw samples, okay? So that's one type of unsupervised learning algorithm where the density is not explicit, it's kind of like implicit in the algorithm. So that's one, I'm not going to discuss this one at all, but it's an important one. And then there is one which I'm going to discuss today, actually. It's clustering. So clustering is when you want to, so you have this data set with M observations, and then you want to divide this data set in into clusters that have some similar characteristics among each of the components or the examples that you have. So, and then, so I have one little example to motivate this. And it is again with the Ising model in 2D, as always, as usual. So we have, so this is the phase diagram of the Ising model. And let's say that this is the magnetization or the average magnetization. So at low temperature, we know this is an order phase where the magnetization is basically big. And then there's a temperature TC at which the model transitions from this ferromagnet to a paramagnet, okay? Okay, so then suppose we create this data set where we draw configurations out of the Boltzmann distribution P at many different temperatures, right? Like here, 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 here. And these are part of our data set, these configurations. Okay, so we have x1, x2, x3 through xm, and they're all sampled out of like all the possible phases where at low temperature and high temperature, even at the critical point. Okay, so the question is there a meaningful way of clustering this the samples or this features in a meaningful way, right? Like, so that's kind of like the idea. And then you can imagine that as usual, so at low temperature, we have what? We have basically configurations that look mostly up, where the spins are polarized up. So I'm going to say app is white, and then you can also have the symmetrically, I mean, the opposite of app is all of them are down. That's also very common to see in this distribution at low temperature. And then at high temperature, you have what? You have basically some random configurations, right? So if you wanted to, let's say, cluster this this data, then you would like to see what? Kind of like you would like to see these three things well separated in some space that you defined, right? And so a clustering algorithm would do something like this. It would be, I don't know, whatever abstract space you use like to define the clustering, and then you would see, I don't know, some sort of like three things where like most configurations in your data set are around here, where most, let's say most pins are up. So this is the up cluster. And then here you have one where you see the down cluster, and then here you see which the completely random ones. Okay, and this is random. So clustering is kind of like, it helps you understand data sets, and you can use them as a visualization of your data when you don't understand it. So in here, we understand the whole thing pretty well. I'm just trying to kind of like to make the point that clustering can be useful for you to understand and visualize your data. Another example that you can use is this handwritten digits dataset. So you have a big bunch of numbers like from 0, 1 through 9, and they're images, and you can also do clustering. So what would you expect when you do a clustering of this MNIST dataset?
Being optimistic, 10 clusters, but...
No, there are 1 should be clustered together, and 2 should be clustered together, yeah. And 3 should be clustered together.
Right, exactly.
Does that happen?
It does, right? So you, if you do that, then you'll see a cluster of... You'll see basically 9. 9 of them, right? Like, but for instance, some people write 7 this way, and some other people write 7 this way. So what would you see, for instance, for the cluster of 7?
We'll split into 2 parts.
Yeah, exactly. So that,
not really split, but consist of 2 parts.
Exactly. So that's the point of the clustering. It helps you kind of like make sense out of like the subtleties in the data, right? Like, so when you do clustering for the digits, that's what you see. You see, I don't know, like a cluster of 7s this way, and then one which kind of like separates a little bit, but with some overlap with this one. Okay, sorry, this is how I write it. And then, I don't know, would you expect to see 1 near the 8, or you expect 5 near the 8?
I would say 5. 5 to 8.
Sorry, we'd say 5 is closer to the 8, right? Mm-hmm. So, because 5 is almost an 8 if you just... So 5 and 8, they're not so distant, right? Like in some Hamming distance type, so you almost complete it this way. So then 5s are closer to 8s and so on, right? And also people write 1 this way. Some other people write it this or that, like there's some... And then when you do the clustering and you have a look at the ones, then they cluster according to kind of like how they look like and so on, right? Like, so it's kind of like a clustering is can be pretty useful when you don't understand the data, and then you do the clustering and then you start seeing patterns. Okay, so that's the point of the clustering.
Is it that before clustering you need to do some kind of dimension reduction?
Clustering itself is kind of like a dimensional reduction, right? Like, because like for instance this these images, they're pretty high dimensional. They live in a real, if you have 28 by 28 images, then
28 dimensions.
Yeah, so they're pretty high dimensional, and then you would like to visualizing this space is difficult. And then what you do is you do this clustering, which usually is a two-dimensional plot where you see all these details about the data.
Do you have to define the dimensions of your plot, or the clustering algorithm does it itself?
So typically people do two dimensions or three, mm-hmm. and because that's what we can see, or even one dimension. So, exactly. So you typically do one, two, or three dimensions, which is what you can see.
And but how you define those dimensions? I mean, you compare, as far as I understood, you compare every dot to another dot, right? So then you have like a distant matrix, which is also, you know, highly dimensional.
Yeah.
And then you want to see it into the three dimensions, but you have to choose those three.
Yeah, so you have, and then the specifics of the clustering algorithm are this selection of what, like, what's this?
Yes. Okay.
Like how you choose this new X and Y, mm-hmm. and how, and sometimes it's like they're very easy to interpret and so on, but sometimes they're not. And so the details of the algorithm is exactly that, right? Like defining what you pick as your new dimension.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I'll describe a few in a little bit. Let me see if I had to say something else. Clustering, and so let me just make a comment about what's unsupervised versus supervised learning, and if like whether they're formally defined or not. They're not, okay? They're almost the same from a probabilistic perspective. So let me make that comment. Okay, so kind of like a question mark, and then we're going to do the answer right away. So I'm going to do it in this like this probabilistic use of unsupervised learning. So the idea is given a data set X, 1 through XM, learn P of X, where X is in, like it lives in, I don't know, for instance, reals of N, right? So it's a vector with N components. It doesn't have to be real, but let's say X has N components. And so as we said, the goal is to, in this unsupervised case, is to learn this P, okay? And in the super, like, I guess the point is, this is for unsupervised learning. And for supervised learning, you can think of the problem of unsupervised learning as learning or estimating a conditional distribution. Okay, so the idea is we have examples of X through XM, plus we have labels for each. Okay, so we have that plus Y1, Y2 through YM, and then the idea with supervised learning is to, like, given an image. That's the condition, predict the label, right? Like, is it a cat or a dog, or is it a 1 or a 2, or is it order configuration or disordered?
So that's basically the regression.
Yeah, it's very similar to regression, right? Like, but in terms of probability, what we're trying to learn is not this one, but given an image or a spin configuration or any of those examples, learn the probability that you assign label Y to that. And then so I guess the observation is that when you think about those two problems, they're not there's no distinction between the two because of the following, right? Like so they're not formally different. Or, so they're not formally different because of this rule. So, because P of X can be written down like so. I don't know if you remember this from stats, but this is chain rule of probability, right? Like where you can decompose a high dimensional distribution P of X, where X is X is this vector, right? Like is X1, X2 through X n. We said that they were n-dimensional vectors, and you can write it down this way. So it's the chain rule of probability, 1 through n of p of xi given x1 through x I minus 1. Okay, so this is what they call the chain rule, and so it means that if we're trying to learn this, it is equivalent to learning n supervised learning tasks, okay? Because you're decomposing this p in terms of the product of n probabilities, which look exactly like this, which is the supervised learning problem. So that's the point. So people say supervised and unsupervised, but ultimately they are intimately related. If you think about unsupervised learning as learning these conditionals, okay? So it's an important distinction. And then indeed, I think by the end of the week, I'm going to show you one example where we can do an unsupervised learning task P of X using exactly this recipe, okay? So a big bunch of supervised learning conditionals, or n of them. Okay, so we're going to do this on Thursday. Okay, and then likewise, you can do the opposite, right? Like you can start from p of y and x. Let me see, or x and y. So if you learn this, this is the joint distribution of the images and the labels, or the features and the labels. Out of this one, if you did the unsupervised learning, then you can marginalize and get the conditional, okay, using Bayes' rule. So what is what is p of y given x, which is the supervised learning case? Is this p of x and y? If you were able to learn it and then divide it by sum over y of p, x, and y. So they're not formally defined. Like, you can go from one to the other and vice versa. Okay? So it's just an important observation. Okay, so that's just a comment. And let me just move on to the example that I wanted to discuss of principal component analysis, which is one of the simplest clustering algorithms that we can discuss. Okay? All right. Let me do that. Do you have any questions about any of this? Okay, so let me go ahead with the idea of principal component analysis. So the idea with principal component analysis is to generate a lower dimensional representation of the data. So this is kind of like what we were discussing before. When I mentioned clustering, I didn't give you any particular example. So this is one of them. Okay. So we want low dimensional of the data. Notice that I don't use any labels at all, so it is cracked, right? So it's one of
you're like,
oops, sorry.
Big brother. So as I said, so it's one of those unsupervised learning algorithms because we're not having any labels at all, even though, like as I explained, there's no formal distinction between the two. So what's the experience again, or the data is just a set of features x, one, x two, x three through x m. Okay, where each of those are n-dimensional vectors. So you can imagine that this data set is just this the giant matrix of data points. So it's an m by n matrix, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so how do we? Construct this principal component analysis? How do we create this low-dimensional representation of the data? So there are many ways, but the one in PCA is the one that I'm going to discuss right now. It's based upon a linear transformation of the of this vectors x. Okay, so it is so how so perform. On the data x, on each of these vectors xi. Okay, so then there's an assumption there, right? Like that if we want to perform this linear transformation, we want to make sure that there's a linear transformation that does something meaningful to your data. Okay. Which may or may not be the case, depending on the problem. Okay, so the assumption is that performing this linear transformation is useful. This may or may not be the case, depending on the data, as always, right? Like, so this algorithm will work or not if there's a linear transformation that generates a representation that is meaningful to us, that we can understand. Okay, okay, so that's the assumption. So. So what are the principal components? So the principal components are defined this way. Let me just tell you. So they're such that the data, so it's a new basis set in which the data basically looks uncorrelated. Okay, and in a precise meaning, like in a precise way. So I'm going to tell you what I mean by uncorrelated. And the idea is that when you have uncorrelated data, this is like when you have truly like the most meaningful, like the essential aspects of the data, right? Like because when you have, for instance, x and y, and they're highly correlated, it's just enough to know x to know what y is. Okay. So, for instance, in this plot, x and y, suppose this is the data, okay? So they're highly correlated, right? Like the values of x and y are like super correlated. We know what the correlation is. So it is like for this data set, it is enough to know x to infer y, okay? And then, so the idea is that when you construct a representation where like there's no correlations, then you need to know x, and that's as much as like you will need. And then the next component, or the second component, or second principal component, is going to have like again they're going to be decorrelated from your initial variable x, and so on, right? Like so. Then you're not redundant. So in some sense, when you reduce correlations, what you're doing is reducing redundancy in the representation. Okay, so that's the point. Okay, so let me show you one definition that I'm going to use. So if you have, so I'm going to quantify correlation now. So what do I mean by correlation? So let me tell you what I mean. So you have, if I have a vector A, which is, A1 through AN, and then B, again, B1 through BN. So there's a way to quantify the correlation between A and B through something called covariance matrix. Okay? So what's covariance matrix is denoted by AB is this quantity. This is 1 over N minus 1 AB transpose. Okay, so this is what people call covariance matrix. Okay, so it measures the correlations between these two variables, or the, between x, like there's variables in here and in here in D. Okay, so that's going to be my measurement of correlation in my data set. So if you generalize this idea, so you can define Sx as what? As 1 over n minus 1 x times x transpose. Okay. Okay. So is this is a matrix, and the idea is that the diagonal of the matrix is the variance of the data. If you agree with that, and then the off diagonal elements are. So let me just write down. So diagonal. Is the variance of x, or this x1 through x2, x3, and so on. So the variance of the components of x. And then the off-diagonal. So the what are the off-diagonal ones? Are the covariances in the data, the correlation. In the meaning, how are the different components of X correlated with each other? Correlation. Okay, and then so as I was saying, what we want is to find a representation of the data that is a linear transformation of this variables x that decorrelates them, that decorrelates the variables in this new basis set. So that's the idea. So. So what do we want? So we want y equals p of x such that that the correlations in this new variable y, which is a linear transformation of your data, that they have little correlations. And then, as I said, the correlations in the data were in the off-diagonal elements of your covariance matrix. Okay? So what we want is to find a transformation P such that this matrix XY is what?
Diagonal is possible?
It is diagonal. Yeah, exactly. So that's what we want. So we want to find transformation P such that this S is diagonal. Because then this matrix is going to be, okay, so the Yeah, so the correlations between this y, these new variables, this this principal components are going to be completely decorrelated. So that's kind of like the motivation, or the one way I like to introduce PCA. So there are many other ways, but this is the one that I chose to present. So let me just express that idea.
You just need to do the matrix diagonalization.
Right. So the idea of PCA. Yeah, exactly. So you have this linear transformation P that transforms your data X, and then such that SY equals just 1 over n minus 1, or m, that is diagonal. Then P are, so that these are called the principal components. X, right? So what is SY? Well, it is right, like it's 1 over n minus 1. Then we replace this, right? Like so it's P times X times PX transpose, which is basically PX and then X transpose, P transpose, divided by M minus 1. Sorry, N. Right? And so this is kind of like a, what is this? Is this, right? Like it's SX. Right? So it's a linear transformation on SX. Okay. So basically what we need to do is what? We want basically that this matrix is diagonal. So basically what we need to do is to diagonalize this matrix X, and then the eigenvectors of of SX are this here. Okay, so nothing surprising. So let me just make a note here that people usually diagonalize, they write this, right? Like a P diagonal matrix times P minus 1. I'm using, so S is symmetric, and so P transpose, because S is symmetric. And then the other thing that I am doing is I'm using kind of like a different notation than what you do typically in linear algebra, where like instead I use this D. Okay, so basically with respect to the traditional notation, what I'm using is the trans, like instead of P, here I do the trans, I define this P as the transpose, but there's no difference. So it's just because typically people are more used to seeing this than this, okay? But it's just a redefinition of what's the linear transformation, okay? Is that clear? So there's no mystery here, just that, yeah, just wanted to make that comment. Okay, so what we want is to diagonalize this such that the x we write down as p transpose d p. Okay? Meaning that we've diagonalized this matrix, and that's it, right? Then what? Then this is what? If we use this, it's basically 1 over n minus 1 times a diagonal. So bring in this thing in here. Or in here. So there's no mystery, right? Like it's just a little change of verb, or like just replacing this in here. So so these new variables is are the directions where the data looks more natural or more decorrelated. And let me just do a plot quickly to explain this. I'll do it here. So if you have your so and then suppose your data looks something like this. Okay. Okay, so there's clearly some correlation between x1 and x2, but there's somehow some noise, right, that decreases that correlation. So if you do a principal component analysis on this type of data, what you will find is that these new components are this roughly these two. So these are going to be your y1. So basically, this is the direction with the largest variance, so the eigenvalue with the largest magnitude, which relates to the variable with the largest variance, right? Like, because as we said, the diagonal of this matrix XY was what? Was the variance of the variable of these new variables SY. Okay? So if you order D and by the magnitude, then the first component, that's the one corresponding to the first direction y1, is the one with the largest variance, which is what? Is this direction along which you have the strongest fluctuations, all right? And then the second one is, if I order this d in decreasing order, it's going to be this direction, okay? And because of the properties of eigenvalue decomposition, those vectors are orthogonal, so it is this direction orthogonal to y1. And so if you want, we've created this representation where the data, where you separate the strongest fluctuations of the data in the different components. So if you want, if this was considered to be noise, this it would be the signal, right? So I'm just like quote unquote, because sometimes there's signal in several components, okay? Okay, so this is kind of like a cartoon of what the resulting PCA algorithm would look like in a data set that looks like this.
That's the signal for Y1 specifically?
Yeah, so yeah. Like if we wanted to say, okay, there's a signal and a noise, and we wanted to separate the noise out of the signal. So I said quote unquote because sometimes there's signal in both directions. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be noise. So when you do separate in components, sometimes you get a meaningful, if you want, signal along the y direction, but also along the y2 direction. Okay.
You just have to make the distribution of the eigenvalues you obtained, because as far as I know, eigenvalues shows how much contribution each of your new component makes in your original data.
Right.
And then you make a distribution, and then you see how many So if you had multidimensional data, how many new dimensions are meaningful?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So what you see is, so if you take this eigenvalues, D, so they're a set of numbers, right? Like it's just a diagonal matrix. What you typically see is like some of them are very meaningful, and then after a cutoff, then basically this can be considered noise. Mm-hmm. So basically what I said here is that the first component, let's say the D1 was very strong, mm-hmm. and then the D2 was considered noise. So you could, in principle, get rid of it and keep the most important information. Okay, so that's a good observation. Let me just tell you, finally, as a last example, how this would look like if you did it for the Ising configurations, okay? For the data set that I was discussing. And this, I encourage you to read one paper that I'm going to just write it down right now. So again, we have the magnetization. Temperature. So this is the ferromagnet, the paramagnet. And then you collect data out of the Boltzmann distribution for different temperatures. And so what is this X data matrix? Sorry, X is something that looks like this, right? Like it's, I don't know, up, down, down, up. Then, like for n spins, so it's n components. And then you have, I don't know, other ones. This one is in the low temperature phase, for instance. Here at high temperature is random, up, up, down, and so on, right? So what if you did principal component analysis on this data set for the Ising model? So what would you expect to see?
Clusters.
You expect to see clusters, right? Like according to hopefully three clusters, right? Like as I was saying before, you expect to see some which...
all up, all down.
Or completely random, right? Yeah. So, and then, so exactly. So what I encourage you to read is this paper. So, it's zero, zero, three, one, eight. So it's Lei Wang. So he did that analysis on the Ising model, took all those configurations and performed principal component analysis on this data. And what he found is this is 0, 0. This is Y1. So what he found is that...
Y2, right?
So, yeah, sorry. What he found is three clusters, right? So one here, and one here. Okay. So can someone tell me what this P is like, this P1 is like for this particular, or can you make a guess? So it's a linear transformation on the spin configurations. And it separates the data into these three clusters.
Which is the up and down, up and down are on the sides, and the mixture is in the middle, like random one in the middle.
Right.
Some all of them. Some all of them. Average or
average over all of them. Yeah. So the P1, if you want, is basically a constant, 1/n. Okay, meaning that when you do P times X, what you get is the magnetization. Okay, so basically P times x. So p1 times x is basically 1 over n. Sorry, the number of spins. Sum over I, sigma I. So it's a linear transformation on your data, which is there, which are these spin configurations that separates those configurations into three clusters. So if you take data in here at low temperature and you found one which like where the spins are all up, then you get high magnetization, and then you take that point and it just draws it here. Okay. If you take one at infinite temperature, then on average the magnetization is going to be very small. So you take this principal component, so this is y1, you plot it for that configuration, you land somewhere here. And if you do it for a low temperature again, but where the spins are mostly down, and you do again the same calculation, you land here. And so that's what he found out. Okay. And so the spectrum of the, so this D is like basically one big eigenvalue, which represents this variance of the magnetization, and then basically the, like pretty fast going to zero for the higher components. Okay. So that's what he found, and I encourage you to read. It's a very like a concise paper, very nice. And with that, I would like to conclude a little bit earlier, but if you have questions or let me just emphasize one last thing is these transformations are linear. Okay. So if you have for instance this digits, this data set for MNIST, and you apply principal component analysis, the results are not as striking as like well separated into 10 clusters and so on, because so this data set is way harder to analyze. So when you do this type of linear transformations, you don't get this nice separation that you see, for instance, in this system, but only because we know that linearly separating these configurations is doable, right? Like, because we know the strongest, we're like, if you want, as physicists, we're the ultimate dimensionality reduction machines, because we went from this space of configurations, which is 2 to the n, where n is the number of spins, to a one-dimensional representation where we know what the most important aspect of the data is, what's the magnetization, right? So basically, when we study phase transitions and so on, we're using dimensionality reduction to the extreme case of like one dimension, right? Like, because we're trying to differentiate a big bunch of configurations or like large state space into 1D, okay? Because when we study a phase transition, we just tune one parameter and then we track, oh, is the order parameter finite at low temperature or zero at high temperature? Okay, so in that sense, we always find kind of like an order parameter for a phase transition is kind of like a dimensionality reduction for a complex high-dimensional system. And we know that some order parameters are linear, but some others are not. Okay, and so PCA is natural when we know or when we have intuition for which, like, okay, the order parameter may be linear, and so this thing can discover it. But many order parameters are pretty nonlinear, right? Like in quantum physics, we have order parameters based, for instance, on the winding numbers and so on, so topological features and so on, very, very nonlinear. Or even the energy is nonlinear. Okay, so you won't be able to separate these clusters according to the energy, which you can, because these are lower energy, these are typically higher energy according to the energy, because the energy is nonlinear in sigma. Okay, so just as a comment again about linearly separable or linearly learnable clustering techniques. Okay.
You should have some input information about your data.
In principle, yes. The more you know, the better you pick algorithm, right? And then, yeah, so let me conclude with 5 minutes.
I have a question, but it's not very general for a question, so I need to try something, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
No one has any questions.